It's up for debate today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Forget doom and gloom. This scientist argues that humanity is actually becoming less violent.
We're a clever species. We solve problems. When things go well, we remember the solutions that work and apply more of them.
And speaking of debates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton go toe-to-toe tonight. We look at where the candidates stand on big global issues, but bear in mind,
nobody has a fully formed plan for dealing with the world that survives contact with the facts and contact with the reality of being president.
Plus, we sample some Elizabethan insults.
We could call you a rotten hornibus or a stinking Jakes, and then a whole load of other terms that I don't think I could get away with on radio.
That's all today here on The World. Thanks for being with us. You know what day it is. The two leading presidential candidates face off on TV tonight. Perfect opportunity for all of us to ask, which candidate do we want in the White House for the next 4 years? Who can help make our country and the world safer? You know, what if, just hypothetically, there's a war? Sorry, but war is something we focus on here at The World.
But you don't say, where are things going right?
That's Steven Pinker, experimental psychologist and proponent of a theory that says, and I'm probably going to oversimplify this, we humans are less violent now than we have ever been in history. So before we get to our main stories today and before the big debate tonight, we want to take a moment to reality check the violence we cover day in and day out here on a news program like The World.
What about all of the parts in the world that used to be in flames, just consumed by war, but which are now at peace?
Yeah, very good question. Steven Pinker and his Harvard colleague Richard Wrangham were on stage with me here in Boston last week. I asked them to consider our prospects as a species for living in peace with each other. Here's Pinker again.
For 450 years, from 1500 to 1950, wars got less frequent but more damaging. That is, there were fewer fights that grew into wars. When they did happen, they killed more people per year, a kind of perverse efficiency in how quickly you could kill people. And then there was a turnaround after World War II, after that big spasm of violence. After World War II, both the number of wars and the rate of death per war have gone down in tandem.
So we seem to be getting better at living together without killing each other. Just don't tell that to the people of Syria. But let's not ignore the genetic piece to this puzzle. Richard Wrangham is a primatologist who for decades has worked with chimpanzee populations in Tanzania.
In the 1960s, people used to say that humans were the only species in which individuals were motivated to go out and kill members of the same species. And there's a lot wrong with that statement. But what was dramatic starting in the 1970s was the discovery that a species that was as closely related to us as any, chimpanzee, was the only one then known in which adult males regularly go off on border patrols and make efforts to penetrate into neighboring areas and indeed damage and kill members of neighboring groups. So this was a kind of, you know, primitive warfare which really shocked people because it reflected the possibility that there is something deep in our evolution about our own tendencies for killing.
So some important similarities between humans and chimps, but Wrangham also sees some important differences.
This was the first time anything like this had been seen in chimpanzees, and it coincided with the fact that Jane Goodall gave bananas to bring the chimps to a central area in their territory so that she could get to see them very closely and get them comfortable with her presence. Well, that naturally led to the possibility that the bananas had something to do with this.
Created some sense of competition.
Exactly, that fighting over the bananas, because they certainly did. I mean, it's like you know, putting money in front of people. Mm. So the chimps did squabble, as it were. Mm. But, you know, there's a very different kind of fighting between fighting erupting over competition for something to this very planned, deliberate attempt to go and attack members of the neighboring groups, because that did not emerge out of any kind of hot emotion.
Richard Wrangham has spent a lot of his professional life trying to understand why groups of chimpanzees go to war. He says neighboring groups avoid aggression when there is a balance of power and when neither group has a clear advantage, something the world's diplomats seem to need to rediscover again and again. I asked Steven Pinker whether we humans can do better than chimps, whether over time the reasons nations go to war are decreasing.
Yeah, it's actually, I would say that some of the reasons are decreasing, because as we have a more integrated economy, both globally and within countries, as there are more opportunities for positive-sum cooperation as opposed to zero-sum competition, then it becomes less tempting to engage in violence. There's a line from The Godfather, I don't like violence, I'm a businessman. Blood, right. Blood is a big expense.
Yeah, right.
And as blood becomes a bigger expense, and as you buy and sell things as opposed to plundering things, other people become more valuable alive than dead. And there is both within a country and globally a correlation between engaging in commerce and refraining from war. You don't kill your customers.
Or to riff on another line from The Godfather, leave the gun, take the cannolis. Make pastries, not war. Steven Pinker and Richard Wrangham spoke with me last Thursday at the Science Media Awards and Summit in the Hub right here in Boston. Yeah, long name. People just call it SMASH. Let's focus now on a country where something's going right, as Pinker might say, where a long civil war is coming to an end, Colombia. The government there has been fighting against leftist FARC rebels for over 50 years. The war has killed nearly a quarter of a million Colombians and displaced millions of people. But today, Colombia is taking a huge step forward with the official signing of a peace agreement between the government and the rebels. That does not mean the agreement goes into effect immediately, though. Before that can happen, the deal needs to be approved by a majority of Colombians in a nationwide referendum. That's coming up this Sunday. My BBC colleague Natalio Cosoy is in Cartagena, the site of today's signing ceremony. So how huge is this day for Colombians, Natalio? What does the ink on the paper actually change?
Well, it's a massive date because it means the celebration of the agreement that's been reached by the FARC and the government. It's a formal signature between President Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia and the leader of the FARC, Rodrigo Londoño Echeverri, also known as Timochenko. What it means is that they have managed to wrap up 4 years of negotiations that took place in Havana, where it took a long way and effort to reach an agreement that would satisfy both sides. But after reaching that, they've managed to cease the fire between one side and the other. So the deaths from the conflict and attacks from the FARC and the army have been massively reduced in the last few months and disappeared after the ceasefire was started a few weeks ago. So Colombians are already living in a new situation. But as you very well said, it is not all over yet. We have to wait for a few days to see if the Colombian people will back these agreements in a referendum that Mr. Santos was very insistent. He said the Colombian people should have the final word. And some here in Colombia don't really trust the agreement. One of the biggest criticisms has to do with justice. They feel that they will get away with not enough punishment in the cases where they have committed serious crimes.
Is it true the pen to sign the deal today is made of old bullets from the war?
That's exactly the case. It's a word in Spanish that they made up here, palígrafo, which combines the word for bullet, which is bala, and for pen, which is bolígrafo. So it's palígrafo. So it's given out to every important guest, such as presidents, the 17 Latin American presidents attending the ceremony.
Yeah, well, it is certainly emblematic of the peace. Some Colombians didn't think they'd ever see this day. What are you hearing from Colombians today?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Some people really feel this is a life-changing time for country. They're saying very loudly, I am extremely happy and proud, and I hope this actually means we're going to see a new Colombia. But as I said, others are worried. So they don't feel that the agreement is enough, and they do worry. But I think we'll have to wait a bit for the referendum. That will give us the final word to really know what's going on. Because I've been walking around the country, and I get voices for and against the referendum. And in general, you can get very good arguments, although some of the arguments that you can hear from the no camp sometimes are not based on actual fact, but more on emotion. Even President Santos told me that he understands the fact that the level of justice might not be enough for some, because those who have committed serious crimes might manage to avoid a jail sentence if they tell all the truth in front of the tribunals that will be set up specially to deal with their cases. They will have to pay community service. They will have to spend years in the territories where they caused the damage that they have caused. But they will not be forced to be in jail if they confess to all their crimes. That's something that for certain people will never be enough.
Well, a lot of sidebar considerations today, but for you, Natalio, does this feel historic there in Cartagena?
This is a great day for anyone working in this business. It means covering something that we don't usually get to see, especially in the world, in the condition it is now. We're constantly reporting about wars, about conflicts, and being able to be here to see how a country reaches the end of at least one of its conflict situations, it is definitely an historic moment, and we all should be proud to be able to be covering this.
My BBC colleague Natalio Cossoy at the Press Center in Cartagena, Colombia. That's the site of the signing of the peace agreement today. Thank you very much, Natalio.
Cheers.
While Colombia celebrates what we hope is the end of 5 decades of civil war, in Mexico, the search is still on for answers in a human rights case that's divided the nation for the past 2 years. Today is the second anniversary of the disappearance of 43 students in the Mexican state of Guerrero. They're known as the Ayotzinapa 43, after the town where they attended a teacher training college. A government investigation concluded that the students were detained by corrupt local police officers. The police then reportedly turned the 43 over to drug cartel gang members who allegedly executed the students. But 2 years later, there's still no conclusive evidence, and the fate of the students remains a mystery, not to mention that the investigation has been stalled for a while now. Many accuse Mexico's federal government of complicity in the case. L.A.-based musician Gabriel Garcia doesn't want people to forget the Ayotzinapa 43. Garcia fronts the band Changi Majadero. On the group's debut album, they perform a tune dedicated to the missing students. It was written by Gabriel's dad, Felix Garcia.
My father writes Mexican corridos, but with a political twist, because nowadays the corridos that you hear are all about violence and narco culture. And my dad actually writes corridos with a conscious twist. It doesn't just talk about that situation, it also talks about other massacres that's happened in Mexico and how Ayotzinapa isn't the only situation. That's a reoccurring situation where the Mexican government is very oppressive towards its people, towards the students, towards teachers, and how the narcos, the drug dealers, and the government is one and the same. You know, they're partners. And how this is affecting the violence. Narcostado mexicano, represivo y criminal, de Ayotzinapa aguas blancas, sin olvidarnos de aquel, son genocidios de estado de lesa humanidad. Sí, si vivos se los llevaron, vivos deben regresar.
By the way, both of Garcia's parents are from Mexico. He was born in Los Angeles, and he describes himself as a product of the East LA music scene, a scene that gave us so many great artists. Yet his band's central inspiration is the traditional music of Eastern Cuba. That's Changi, and there's plenty of it in Changi Majadero's debut album. So we're going to leave you with a taste of that. This track is called Soy Campesino. Compadre Pancho, vamos payatera. Compadre Pancho, vamos payatera. En casa compadre Pipi la rumba va a comenzar. En casa compadre Pipi la rumba va a comenzar. Tenga cuidado con el perro, aunque usted vaya a caballo. De reactivo canta el gallo y la gallina cacarear. Perrea el chivo, canta el gallo y la gallina cacarear. Great music there from Gabriel Garcia's band Changi Majadero. You're listening to The World. The government in Jordan is under fire today, accused of not doing enough to protect writer Nahed Nhatar. He was shot dead yesterday right in front of a courthouse in Amman, where he was facing trial for insulting Islam. Jonathan Geyer in Cairo has been following the story. He's a fellow at the Institute of Current World Affairs. He studies cartoons and satire in the Middle East. And he says the charges against Hattar stem from a cartoon the writer posted on Facebook.
Marco, this is an incredibly offensive cartoon for the devout. In it, there is an angry-looking sheikh in bed with two women, and there's this kind of gentle, white-bearded giant opening a door to the tent, asking if the sheikh needs anything. And the man asks this giant figure to bring him wine, to bring him cashews. And there's a caption that says, "Heaven of ISIS," or Daesh, the Islamic State.
Can you just briefly explain the cartoon? Because it's a little dense.
Absolutely. And let me tell you, the cartoon has a lot of words on it. It's not your usual 1-2 punch of a cartoon. The joke here is a kind of ISIS fighter sitting in heaven, bossing around God. The joke actually goes to the heart of, you know, what is righteousness, and saying that these Islamic State fighters are, of course, not devout, not religious, and they are the affront to God. However, the way these cartoons often work when they're playing that fine line of satire about religious extremism is that in making fun of extremism, the cartoon itself is considered extreme.
First thing that occurs to me, the fact that Hattar didn't draw this cartoon, he actually took it off Facebook and apologized later. Do you think that matters much anymore? Is the risk these days equal for the creator as it is for the person who shares the cartoon?
Social media just opens up the doors to a totally different conversation about free speech, where it's not just the cartoonist who's always been under threat, but it's also anyone who shares, likes, disseminates a cartoon or a joke that could be deemed offensive opens the door to their own persecution or prosecution. It's been seen in a different sense in Egypt. There was a young 22-year-old who shared a Facebook meme, a photoshopped image of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi with Mickey Mouse ears. Now, that 22-year-old ended up behind bars for making fun of the president, and he didn't make that Mickey Mouse Photoshop image. So basically, Facebook, Twitter are now realms that are being surveilled by states and religious groups.
In Jordan, it's a monarchy. Freedom of speech is not a given. And Hattar's family is blaming the government for putting him on trial for posting the cartoon and making him the target of death threats. What do you make of that?
There's a lot of issues to unpack here, Marco. Hattar comes from a Christian family. He professed atheist views, but he also, before he was killed with these three bullets, he expressed support for the dictator Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He severely criticized the Jordanian monarchy. He's a contested character, and with that comes a whole muddied water of the motive behind this assassination. The Committee to Protect Journalists, the Arab Human Rights Network, they've all condemned the government for not protecting Hattar to the extent that he needed, because he was seen as a, you know, a nefarious character in the eyes of many.
With Jordan bordering Syria, the country has been seen as a place of relative calm in the region. It's where a lot of refugees end up in some of those large camps there. But what does this mean for Jordan that Hattar was killed there?
Jordan is, you know, a bastion of stability in comparison to the region. It butts up against Syria, Iraq, and Israel. It's always seen as conducting a kind of balancing act. And the fear is that, you know, it's also a tinderbox. One thing I would note, Marco, is that Jordanian cartoonists have been attacking ISIS in their drawings, you know, from day one of this new phase of the Iraq and Syria conflict. And many of the cartoonists themselves have faced death threats from ISIS. So this is also a huge concern. Mm. Really, I mean, Hattar represents a really tragic example of free speech, but it's really just the tip of the iceberg of much larger concerns about expression, satire, the press, etc., in a quite difficult region.
Jonathan Geyer is a fellow at the Institute of Current World Affairs, where he researches cartoons and satire in the Mideast. Thanks very much, Jonathan, as always.
Thank you, Marco.
You probably know the drill here on Public Radio. We try to keep the discourse courteous and respectful, but those standards may slip a little with this next story. Some of the language will be quite strong. That is, if you're familiar with Elizabethan insults from the west of England. Todd Gray is a historian at the University of Exeter in Britain. His new book is called Strumpets and Ninnycocks, Name-Calling in Devon, 1540 to 1640. Gray has put together an incredibly detailed study of the worst and most obscene insults from that time. So, Todd, thanks for being here. What does incredibly detailed study of cussing actually entail? Were you excavating bathroom walls from the 16th century?
Well, I went through the church court records, which are all about slander, from 1500 to 1640, and there are 40,000 pieces of paper. They tell us what everyday people were saying to each other that was objectionable.
So do your best here. If you wanted to really hurt my feelings in the 16th century, what would you tell me to do?
Well, we could call you a rotten Hornibus or a stinking Jakes.
All right, let's just start with rotten Hornibus. What does that even mean?
Rotten could be not just what we think of as decayed, but sort of old, cuckold, a man whose wife is unfaithful because he's either unable to control her or he can't satisfy her. So you're getting at the wife, but you're getting at him as well.
Right. And stinking Jakes?
Well, I think the closest you could say is in America would be a smelly outhouse.
There's another phrase, ninny hammer. What is a ninny hammer?
Well, a ninny hammer is also a man whose wife is unfaithful and he's foolish with it. He doesn't possibly realize that his wife is running around behind his back.
Any insults from that 16th century period which have retained their power to the current day?
Well, that's the thing. The most common one for a woman is a word which rhymes with door, and they're much more imaginative. Scatological insults are very common to use against authority figures. The word turd is very common, but the one they really like is fart. You know, I don't care a fart for you. And there's one case where a constable arrests a man, and the man says, "Bring the mayor to me and I shall fart in his mouth."
So you've heard about this big debate we have here in the United States tonight?
Yeah, I was wondering if any of these words would be used.
I was going to ask you. I mean, let's say Donald Trump attacks Hillary Clinton. How should she riposte a la 16th century?
Well, she would have called him probably a cucumber.
Okay.
That's really getting at a man's inability to be a man. The sexual terms have altered a bit, but the main issues, which they also got into, you know, calling somebody a drunkard, a beggar, a fool, those are ones we carry forward with us today.
Todd Gray is a historian at the University of Exeter in Britain and the author of Strumpets and Ninnycocks, Name-Calling in Devon, 1540 to 1640. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The Cuban-American community in Miami mourns the loss of Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez.
He never tired of showing how grateful he was to be in this country, that miraculous good fortune of his to be in the city of his dreams. He was us. We related to him.
That story's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So this is it. Tonight we finally get to see what happens when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go toe-to-toe in a televised debate. And with just 6 weeks to go before the presidential election, the stakes are huge. Tonight's moderator is Lester Holt of NBC Nightly News, and he's chosen these three topics for discussion: America's direction, achieving prosperity, and securing America. We're going to spend a few minutes on that last one, securing America. It is a pretty broad topic, but we're going to get down to some specifics with Susan Glasser, editor of Politico magazine. So both parties, Susan, want to strengthen homeland security and deal firmly with those who seek to harm America. Let's pull out a few slices from the security puzzle and just talk about a few things. Front and center, ISIS. I mean, both candidates seem to know what to say about ISIS, defeat them, but we haven't heard super clear strategies from each about how to do that. Let's just assume they can defeat ISIS, given enough time. But what about after? How do you defeat the ideology that bred Al-Qaeda and ISIS and any number of angry groups around the world who don't like the U.S.? What plans have you heard from either candidate to counter the ideology?
Well, look, first of all, I think it should go without saying, but I'll say it again up front. Nobody has a fully formed plan for dealing with the world in the midst of a presidential campaign that survives contact with the facts and contact with the reality of being president. So, you know, all presidents are somewhat reactive when it comes to the world inbox. And certainly the way in which we would end up defeating ISIS would certainly color how the U.S. would have a footprint in the Middle East going forward. That being said, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton seem to offer very, very different worldviews. And the bottom line is that Trump has professed somewhat contradictory positions. First of all, he says he has a secret plan to eliminate ISIS, but he has not spelled out those details. That's increasingly become a Clinton campaign talking point. But regardless of whether he has a secret plan or not, your question is, what happens if we do get rid of ISIS? And I think what you're looking at is Trump to continue basically the gradual disengagement with what he views and many others view as sort of the trap of the Middle East that the United States has been in for a long time. He, on the one hand, talks in very muscular rhetoric, but most of his actual foreign policy recommendations seem to suggest somebody who's much more interested in looking inward, who's much more interested in, yes, a muscular nationalism, but one that is really focused here at home in the United States. Whereas Hillary Clinton is really almost a quintessential candidate of the liberal international order. She obviously is a product not only of the Cold War and the post-Cold War, but of her husband's administration, of the smart, targeted use of power, including military power, where warranted, to keep up America's role in the world.
Right. So that suggests she'd still engage in the world and perhaps continue to think about how to disengage these ideologies that create groups like ISIS. Donald Trump focusing on home, if that's his plan anyway, what will that do to dismantle ideologies that aim to target the United States?
Well, to be blunt, I'm not entirely sure. I don't think that Donald Trump has laid out a very coherent plan or sense of nuanced engagement. Mostly when he talks about securing us against threats from terrorism, what he's talking about is how he plans to protect America's borders, not so much what he plans to do internationally. As you know, he talked earlier in the campaign of his very controversial notion of banning Muslims from entering the United States. He doesn't talk about that as much anymore, but I don't believe he's officially disavowed that. Of course, he still has made the wall with our southern border a centerpiece of his policy proposals. Now, largely, of course, that seems to be targeted at Mexican and Latin American immigrants, not so much in a security sense, but at times he uses that as part of his security platform as well.
What about Russia? Does that concern you? Because positions are remarkably different between the two candidates.
Positions, as you said, are remarkably different between the two candidates when it comes to Russia. If anything, I would say, as a longtime Russia watcher myself, this has been one of the most surprising and extraordinary elements of campaign 2016. The fact that Donald Trump not only has professed his repeated admiration for Vladimir Putin, but has done so in the face of repeated criticism from within his own party. Remember, just 4 years ago, it was the Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, who said that Vladimir Putin was the most actor on the world stage when it came to the United States, and that Russia was basically the number one threat. And Barack Obama practically laughed him off the stage at that time. And now you have this incredible flip-flop on the part of the Republican Party's nominee. And already that is, I think, causing the most ripple effect in the world. Because again, you know, we're talking earlier in this conversation about ISIS, about the Middle East. The bottom line is that Trump has had some sort of blustery rhetoric when it comes there, but we actually don't really know very much what he would do. I think he's made it pretty clear on Russia that he would be interested in a major shift, a very specific and major shift in our policy. So that is one area where there just couldn't be a starker contrast, not only between the two candidates this year, but also between Donald Trump and the mainstream of the Republican Party.
Susan Glasser, editor of Politico magazine, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
Russia and the United States actually worked together recently to hammer out a ceasefire agreement for Syria, and it did lead to a partial pause in the fighting there. But in recent days, the diplomatic cooperation has stalled badly. The U.S. ambassador at the U.N., Samantha Power, laid the blame on Russia and the Syrian regime of President Bashar al-Assad. She said they're both guilty of barbarism for bombing aid convoys, hospitals, and first responders. The Russians said America's rhetoric is unacceptable. So what to do about Syria? For those watching what's happening there in horror, that's a question our two major presidential candidates need to address, including at tonight's debate. Here's more from the world's Matthew Bell.
Even by the grim standards of this five-year-old civil war, the news from the city of Aleppo in northern Syria has been particularly shocking in recent days. Caroline Anning is with Save the Children. Speaking from the Turkish city of Antakya, near the Syrian border, she says her group's medical staff inside Aleppo is struggling to keep up with the numbers of injured people.
Continual bombardment, airstrikes going on throughout the day and night, and a huge number of children injured. Most of the casualties in some airstrikes that they have coming in are children, and they just don't have the means to treat them. So the casualties are piling up on the floor. They say the floors are flooded with blood, and they don't have basic kit like ventilators, antibiotics, anesthetics to help those children.
The news from Aleppo should help put things in perspective, says Syrian-American physician Zahir Sahloul. If you ask him, there's only one question that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump need to answer at tonight's debate. Why isn't the U.S. doing more to stop the bleeding in Syria? Sahloul spent some time in Aleppo this past summer caring for the wounded. It was bad then, Sahloul says, but it's gotten a whole lot worse.
I think we have a responsibility as the most powerful country in the world to stop this genocide. And also, if we care about the roots of terrorism, we have to stop this bleeding in Syria, because the chaos that is created by the extreme brutality by the Assad regime is feeding into terrorism, and we have to stop it by stopping this brutality.
Sahloul says the Obama administration deserves credit for sending humanitarian aid into Syria. But he says the president is also guilty of allowing the Syrian regime to kill its own people with impunity.
President Obama basically wanted to not to intervene. I think that was the major kind of principle in Syria.
Sahloul says the question for Clinton and Trump should be, what would they do differently? Amr al-Azam is also Syrian-American. He teaches Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, and he's a member of the Syrian opposition. Al-Azam says the Obama administration has chosen not to take action against the Syrian government's atrocities, and he wants to know how that's going to change with the next president.
When are we going to see the United States provide assertive leadership? Because that's what the rest of the world, you know, rightly or wrongly, is waiting for. Whether we like it or not, that's what the Europeans are waiting for. That's what the rest of the international community is waiting for.
Al-Azam says he would like to hear where Clinton and Trump would draw red lines for the Assad regime and how they plan to make the Syrian military stop killing civilians.
Also, what pressure or what means would they have to persuade the Russians, who are also involved in this carnage, to also pull back and stop bombing the civilian population?
The problem with the Syrian civil war is that it presents such a daunting range of national security challenges for any U.S. president. Beyond the humanitarian disaster, there's the rise of extremist groups like ISIS, the breakup of the country, the chaos spreading across Syria's borders, and the refugee crisis that's hitting Syria's neighbors and reaching all the way into Europe. Syria expert Andrew Tabler of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy says his question to Clinton and Trump would be this.
The recent failure with the Russian initiative over Syria shows that Obama's plan A hasn't worked. So my question to you is, what's your plan B? What can you do differently?
There seems to be agreement on one point, at least, and that's that there's an awful lot at stake in Syria, and that whatever the current U.S. administration is doing isn't working very well. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
One of the unanticipated impacts of the war in Syria is playing out in Turkey, and it has to do with polygamy. It's a practice that was outlawed about 90 years ago in Turkey, but now with the mass arrival of Syrian refugees, polygamy appears to be on the rise as Turkish men take on Syrian women as second and third wives. Fariba Nawa reports from Kilis, near the Syrian border.
Kinda was married to a wealthy merchant in Aleppo, but 4 years ago, he was kidnapped and killed. And the kidnappers also threatened Kinda's young son. So her parents paid a smuggler and fled with Kinda and her son to Turkey. They settled in the small border town of Kilis, which now has more Syrians than Turks. Money was scarce, and Kinda figured if she married again, her parents wouldn't have to support her. So Kinda, who was 29, agreed to marry a 65-year-old Turkish businessman named Jalal. He already had a wife, 3 children, and 8 grandkids.
A lot of people proposed to me, but they wanted me to relocate to Ankara or other cities, and my mom wouldn't agree to that. So when Jalal proposed to me, I prayed for guidance, and I dreamed that it would be a good marriage, so I agreed.
That was 3 years ago. Now Kinde and Jalal have a home separate from Jalal's first family, and they have two young children of their own. Jalal says he married Kinde because he and his first wife weren't getting along.
I was telling friends that I was having problems with my wife, so word of mouth, they found me someone.
He tells me he chose a young Syrian wife because they're beautiful, and they're good housewives, and they're not as financially demanding as Turkish women. Jalal says his first wife agreed to the marriage, but I couldn't confirm that. He didn't want me to talk to her. Anyway, he says, it's his Islamic right to have a second wife, and he thinks the Turkish government should legalize it.
A lot of people can benefit from that. A lot of Syrians are on the streets, and it could be helpful for both sides.
This grandfather isn't the only one making a bid for legalizing polygamy in Turkey. Hasan Açıkalın is a conservative pro-government commentator, and he's advocated for it on TV. He argues that the second wives are being denied legal rights. They're treated like mistresses, without access to inheritance or child support. And the number of these arrangements seem to be rising. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported at least 5,000 polygamous marriages were performed by Muslim clerics in Kilis from 2011 to 2014, and the government is turning a blind eye. One Kilis prosecutor who asked me not to use his name says even lawyers and judges in town have been taking on Syrian wives. It's all in keeping with a government that's becoming more socially and religiously conservative, at the expense of women. That's according to a woman's rights advocate who didn't want to be identified.
Now they are making divorces harder, and they almost banned abortion. And they are encouraging people to get married in an early age. And all this change also makes it very okay to have the polygamy.
As for the Syrian women entering these marriages, they may have little choice. Nur Borhan, a Syrian gender researcher with the Center for Civil Society and Democracy in Gaziantep, says poverty, war, and honor are driving Syrian families to marry off their daughters, some as young as 10, as second and third wives. Kinde, who fled Aleppo, experienced some of that pressure, though she wasn't a child bride. She tells me she's happy with Jalal, that he's a kind and patient man. But as she holds and feeds her new baby, she speaks in Arabic, a language her husband doesn't understand. She says, I don't mind if he keeps his first wife, but I'm worried about my future. If he divorces his first wife, then I'll be the primary wife and my marriage will be registered officially and this can secure my future. For the world, Fariba Nawa, Kilis, Turkey.
A quick look ahead, or rather backwards, at a story we'll have for you tomorrow. Let me explain. In Holland, cyclists rarely get hit by car doors swinging open. That's because of something drivers there do. They reach across with their right hand to open the car door and then look back before opening fully. An American checked it out.
There's no name for it. In fact, they considered it such common sense that no one needed a name for it. Do we have a name for opening the car door with our left hand?
Teaching the Dutch reach. That's tomorrow here on The World. Here is a sad story that's shaken many people beyond the world of baseball. Pitcher Jose Fernandez of the Miami Marlins died over the weekend in a boating accident. The 24-year-old Fernandez was beloved by the team and by the wider Miami community. He was one of us, as Fabiola Santiago puts it. She's a columnist with the Miami Herald, and she says there was a special connection between player and city, due in part to the perilous journey Fernandez made from Cuba to Florida by boat.
In the darkness of night, in the high sea, someone fell overboard from the boat, and he dove right in to get them, and only to discover that it was his mother whose life he was saving.
Right.
And, you know, this is a story that is so common in Miami. And, you know, it's just the quintessential Miami story.
Yeah. Is the fact that it's a well-known story in Miami part of the reason you think that Jose Fernandez was so embraced by the community?
Well, his story resonated in Miami. because, you know, he was a refugee from Cuba's unyielding dictatorship, like so many of us here are. And, you know, this is a city of refuge, a city of exiles and of immigrants. And he never tired of showing how grateful he was to be in this country, of telling the story about that miraculous good fortune of his to be in the city of his dreams. So he was one of us. He was us. We related to him.
So I know the community there is beside itself with sadness. A lot of communities are across this country. What kind of individual reactions have you witnessed there in Miami?
I've seen the fans coming to the stadium with flowers and tears. To just online, people are posting photos of Jose with themselves. He was known to do that. He, after the games, he would kiss his mom, his grandmother, and his girlfriend, and then it was off to meet with the fans. He was that approachable. You know, everybody else kind of walked off the field and went home, and he stayed behind. You know, baseball players are no longer known for that kind of generosity of their time, and that seems like something that was done a long time ago, and he just did it naturally. It for him, it seemed effortless. Yeah. To relate to the people of this city.
Yeah, he was definitely a people person for sure. You know, when it comes to politics, I mean, you called Cuba's dictatorship unyielding. The Cuban Americans in Miami, as you know, can be pretty divided usually over how much the U.S. would like to normalize relations with Cuba. But on Jose Fernandez, it sounds as if this is apolitical and pretty much everyone sees what a loss this is. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, I think that he was candid about telling his story. He didn't get into the politics of it. He told the human story, his story, which I think is the way that we get, you know, we put our stories forth and people understand what's behind the generalizations about a community. And I think he was so good at doing that, at just telling his own little piece of the truth.
What will you remember about Jose Fernandez? What did this 24-year-old pitcher teach you about life?
Oh, his smile on the field, his zest for life and for, you know, living it all and giving it all. I think that that's really what was brought home, because life is just so fragile, so fragile. This is a parent's worst nightmare.
Such a loss. Fabiola Santiago with the Miami Herald, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got time for one more presidential debate preview as we await tonight's contest between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We're pretty certain immigration will come up. Robert Valencia is a writer and political analyst for Global Voices Online, and he's been thinking a lot about where the two main candidates stand on the issue. So, Robert, I know you already have some reservations about this debate and the debates ahead because of the moderators. What are those reservations?
Well, this is perhaps one of the most unpredictable debates we will ever face. My biggest concern is that there are no Latino moderators in this time. You have Lester Holt, you have Martha Raddatz, you have Anderson Cooper, but you don't have prominent Latino media figures who could definitely tackle the issue of immigration in what I consider in a better way than many of the moderators that were chosen.
Do you feel that the moderators who were chosen do not have the expertise?
They could, but here's the thing. This campaign has been centered on Latino issues like never before. The Trump campaign has been run under the suspicion that some Latinos, some Mexicans are good, but the majority of them commit all the atrocities and the, you know, socioeconomic woes that the United States have faced. Now, I'm not suggesting that any of the moderators have no expertise whatsoever, but when you don't have a Latino voice, when you don't have a Latino presence during the debates, the story about Latino Americans in the United States is half-baked, is half-told.
So if you could ask Donald Trump anything, what would that be? What would you ask him?
My main question is if he really believes that Mexico is going to build the wall. I mean, what we saw in Mexico when he visited President Peña Nieto, he was calm during the press conference. But when he arrived in Arizona hours later, he started with his bombastic commentary. So my question is whether he believes that a country like the United States, with all its variety of opinions and ideas and partisanship, could be really run as a company.
as a company with a wall to its southern border.
Exactly.
So if you could ask Hillary Clinton anything, what would that be? Do you have a clear sense of what her proposal is for comprehensive immigration reform?
I would ask if she can provide a comprehensive immigration reform where Latinos who have lived for a certain number of years could stand out of the shadows and actually apply for citizenship. The term Hispandering became viral this year, meaning that politicians pretend to show interest on Latino issues, but in reality, that is not part of the top agenda. So in this case, for Hillary Clinton, she has to demonstrate that she really has a commitment with the Latino community beyond the fact that his running mate speaks Spanish and that she has a Spanish account on Twitter.
So if you come out of tonight's debate, what is the one question you really want answered from both candidates?
Whether they are conscious of the Latino vote and their needs, knowing that the Latino vote is also interested in other issues other than immigration, and what are the plans for economic growth among the Latino community, the importance of healthcare, environment, the way Latinos are being treated at the criminal justice level. I mean, let's not forget that Donald Trump recently said that he would reinstate Stop and Frisk, which have proved detrimental to both the Latino community and African-American communities. That is a form of Hispandering. You cannot talk to the Latino community when you don't know exactly the effects of policies like that. So I guess the question is whether they think that their campaigns are Hispandering or not. I think that would be the most challenging question for both.
Robert Valencia, a writer and political analyst for Global Voices Online. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow with post-debate analysis and, of course, other stories from around the world. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.